I have been emphasizing all along that the central core of the kinds of Oriental philosophy that we're talking about is not theory but experience. And the trouble here is that so long as one attempts to communicate this philosophy in words, we remain in the area of theory and do not necessarily transfer over into experience. It is then for this reason that in addition to the scriptures or verbal teachings of Hinduism, there is a discipline whose object is to enable an individual to realize what the words are about. I would use so strong a word for realization as sensation, because the realization of the tattvam asi, the Upanishadic proposition that you're it, comes over you if you do have the experience, not so much as you feel convinced that the earth goes round the sun, even though you don't actually see this happening. It's not so much like that as it is like an immediate sensation of the thing which the proposition tattvamasi is trying to say. And so this entering into the experience, which is the heart of Hinduism, is the function of a discipline called yoga. The word yoga, Y-O-G-A, don't say, as many people do, yogi. Yogi is one who practices yoga. And a yogini is a female practitioner of yoga. But yoga is the same word as yoke, Latin jungere, to join, and English union. The yoke between two oxen may be regarded equally as a discipline and as a joining of the two oxen. So the basic meaning of yoga is something like union. The realization, in other words, of the union of what we call the separate individual with the ultimate ground of being, Brahman. We don't know how early yoga is in India, but there are statues found in Mohenjo-Daro in the Indus Valley dating from at least 2000 BC of figurines in the posture familiarly associated with yoga, the Padmasana or the full lotus posture, in which almost all Buddhas are seen to be sitting, with the legs crossed and the feet up on the thighs, soles upwards. It apparently then is something quite ancient and was in some way absorbed and assimilated to the Aryan civilization which invaded India from the north somewhere between 15 and 1200 BC. Yoga was apparently, like everything else in those days, handed down as an oral tradition and was not committed to any kind of written record until there appeared a book called the Yoga Sutra. Sutra really means thread, but I suppose through the idea of threaded leaves, ancient manuscripts in India were written on palm leaves, came to mean a scripture or book, sacred book, And the Yoga Sutra is associated with a gentleman named Patanjali, P-A-T-A-N-J-A-L-I, and is of uncertain date. It may be as early as 200 BC, it may be a bit later. But this is the standard text on the practice of yoga. There are Chinese forms of yoga, which probably originated independently at the same time, out of the Taoist way of life, and they subsequently had considerable influence on India, as did the Indian ways on the Chinese. Now, it's important to study the Yoga Sutra from its opening, or second to opening phrase, its second verse. Its first verse says, now yoga is explained. And the commentators attach particular importance to the word now, because the assumption is that something else has gone before. In other words, you are expected to be a reasonably sensible, rational, and mature human being before you engage on this particular path. In the same way as I pointed out to you in the last session, that the Hindus have the view that a man should fulfill the duties of the householder before he engages upon the spiritual life, so in the same way there are certain preparations before you start out on yoga. And those preparations usually involve having mastered whatever the disciplines of your culture may be, the essential disciplines of your culture, so that you know how to handle them. So that if you get into the higher states of consciousness, which yoga brings about, you won't run amok because not being able to distinguish between good and bad from a social point of view. The next verse says, in Sanskrit, I'll write it down because it's important to look at each word. It says, yogas chitta vritti nirodha. This means yoga is chitta. Is a very difficult word to translate into English, because in Sanskrit there are about five words for mind, for our one. Well, we have mind, we have consciousness, we have awareness, thought, but they're all very vaguely defined, and we use them interchangeably. Chitta is a more precise word, and I would say awareness, probably. Vritti comes from a root which means to turn around. And so you get the idea of turbulence, vicious circling, whirlpooling, wavering, anyway, going round and round and round. So yoga is awareness, turbulence, stopping. There it is, all in one sentence. You can take this sort of analogy, which is used by yoga teachers. Take it that awareness is something like a pool of water. When the water is quite still, you can see in it the reflection of the sky and everything in the bottom of the pool. When it's muddy and turbulent, you can't. So in the same way, your awareness of the world is like reflecting pool. And if it's turbulent, you don't see clearly. You're not clearly aware. You don't have a mind like a mirror. You have a mind like a distorting mirror, which keeps wiggling. So yoga then is the art of stilling the mind. There are various schools of thought about what a still mind is. According to one school of thought, the goal of yoga is samadhi. Well, everybody agrees that samadhi is what it's all about. What is this word, samadhi? It refers to a state of consciousness which is Sam. Don't say Sam, that's different. Sam, related to our word, Sam, from the Latin summa, eventually Sanskrit Sam. Complete, total. Also related to the word same. Looking on everything equally, having an equal mind towards all events. Samarasa in Sanskrit, equanimity, calmness. Having, as it were, the same attitude in victory and defeat. Also same in the sense of the knower and the known are the same. There is no further division between myself on the one hand and what I am aware of on the other. It's all one, samadhi. In yoga, there are differentiated two kinds of samadhi. One is called vikalpa, and the other is called nirvikalpa. The word vikalpa means an idea or conception. So there could be a samadhi with an idea in it of some kind, a concept. Nirvikalpa would mean without a concept. Or a samadhi produced by way of a gimmick, a technique, and the ideal samadhi, look mama, no hands, no gimmick. But some schools, as I was saying, there are different opinions about what this all means, interpret nirvikalpa samadhi as being a state in which there is such a degree of absorption or of trance that there is no awareness left of the physical world. You are completely, well, if a psychiatrist looked at you, he would say you were catatonic. Sitting in that posture, immobile, absorbed, rapt. And this is held by one school of thought to be the highest attainment of the human mind. I don't agree with this point of view. I follow another school of thought, which has a different idea of nirvikalpa samadhi. And this, in my view and that of others, it is not the total cessation of sensory input, but simply the cessation of conceptions, of thoughts about what you are experiencing. And therefore, that the meaning of citta vritti nirodha is not, as the other school interprets it, getting a perfectly blank mind. But it means two things in my interpretation. One, a mind that is not going in vicious circles. And two, the mind free from the hypnotic influence exercised by thoughts, ideas, words. So then let's consider, first of all, what is a mind in the grip of vicious circles? Well, one of the most obvious instances that we all know is the phenomenon of worry. The doctor tells you that you have to have an operation. And that has been set up so that automatically everybody worries about it. But since worrying takes away your appetite and your sleep, it's not good for you. So the doctor tells you not to worry because he wants you on the operating table in a state of good health, well rested, etc. But you can't stop worrying, and therefore you get additionally worried that you are worrying, and therefore will not be in the right shape to be on the operating table. And then, furthermore, because that is quite absurd, and you are mad at yourself because you do it, you are worried because you worry because you worry. That is a vicious circle. Another form of vicious circle is when a person is convinced that they ought to be unselfish, and are so convinced for selfish reasons. I would like to think of myself as an unselfish person, because that's the sort of person I'm supposed to be. So, therefore, I have a selfish reason for wanting to be unselfish, and because of that, no amount of effort will ever succeed in making me unselfish, but will only succeed in sending me around in circles. I'll be proud that I'm humble, etc. That is citta vritti, turnings of the mind, see? So now, yoga is initially stopping that. Can you allow your mind to be quiet? Isn't it difficult? Because the mind seems to be like a monkey, jumping up and down and jabbering all the time. Once you've learned to think, you can't stop. And an enormous number of people devote their lives to keeping their minds busy and feel extremely uncomfortable with silence. When you're alone, say in a doctor's waiting room, which may be very uninteresting, nobody's saying anything, there's nothing to do, there's this worry, this lack of distraction. I'm left alone with myself, and I want to get away from myself. I'm always wanting to get away from myself. That's why I go to the movies, that's why I read mystery stories, that's why I go after to girls or anything that you do, or get drunk or whatever. I don't want to be with myself. I feel queer. I feel like, you know how it is when you run your fingernails up a blackboard on a cold day? Creepy. So, well, why do you want to run away from yourself? What's so bad about it? Why do you want to forget this? Why do you want to become absorbed? Because you are addicted to thoughts. And this is a drug, a real dangerous one. Compulsive thinking, going on and on and on and on and on all the time. It's a habit. As you keep telling yourself where you are, who you are, what's going on, how good it is, how bad it is, reading the newspaper of your mind. You know, a lot of people, they get hold of a newspaper, and the newspaper reads them, they don't read it. Newspaper is designed to read you. Typographers, the layout people, have very carefully calculated how to carry your eye from one end of it to another. So there's a difficulty about stopping that activity. And you really have to stop it if you want to be sane. Because if I talk all the time, I don't hear what anyone else has to say. And then I'll end up in the situation of having nothing to talk about but my own talking. Or so in exactly the same way, if I think all the time, I won't have anything to think about except thoughts. And that's the academic fallacy. See, when you add books to the library, a great many of the books that are added to the library are books about books. They're not necessarily books about life, some of them are, but most of the books, especially PhD dissertations, are books about books about books about books. And that doesn't really get us very far. So in order to have something to think about, there are times when you simply must stop thinking. You can learn later on in yoga how to be in the state of samadhi and think at the same time. But first of all, you have to learn how to stop thinking. Well, how do you do that? The first rule is don't try to. Because if you do, you will be like someone trying to make rough water smooth with a flat iron. And all that will do will stir it up. So, in the same way as a muddy, turbulent pool quiets itself when left alone, you have to know how to leave your mind alone. It will quiet itself. There are certain things, however, which help. And the yogis tend to use two techniques for assisting their minds to become calm. One is breathing. That is called pranayama. Prana means breath, or the vital force of the body. Pranayama, the discipline of breath. And the other is called mantra. It's connected with pranayama. It's connected with breathing, but it's chanting sounds. And both of these have a slightly auto-hypnotic effect, which helps one to quiet thoughts. These days, many hippies go around wearing beads. Anybody got beads on? What do you wear beads for? Do you know why you wear them? Do you know what beads are for? Beads are for yoga. This is a Tibetan rosary, which has been blessed by the Dalai Lama. And they wear them on the hand, rather. Well, they carry them around the neck, but they usually use them in the hand. And they will do for timing. You got your yoga practice for the day, and so many rounds of the beads will time you. And either you use the beads for breathing, in, out on one bead, in, out on the next bead, in, out on the next bead, and so. Now they have essentially, the breathing in yoga is not forced. You don't do kind of breathing exercises in a forced way. You have, first of all, to find out how your lungs want to breathe. Let them do that. And count your breath with your fingers, rather than using numbers. Try and keep away from concepts, and numbers are concepts. That's why you use your fingers on the beads instead. And for every in-breath and out-breath, you use one bead. Just experiencing breathing and experiencing the sensation of the beads passing your fingers. Don't think about it. Don't try not to think about it. But the bead and the breathing will distract you from thinking. And you will find that in due course, the breath will automatically become slower and slower and slower with great ease, until it seems that you are hardly breathing at all, it's so slow. Now, for some people, that is not so easy to concentrate on. And so it makes it easier to concentrate if you add to the breathing a mantra. And so the mantra means the chanting of certain syllables, which, although they do have a meaning, and they are maybe the names of the divinity, they very soon cease to have a meaning as you use them. So the Tibetans use such a mantra as Om Mani Padme. Hindus use sometimes just with beads, Ram 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 or more complicated ones. Om Ram Shri Ram Jai Jai Ram. Om Ram Shri Ram Jai Jai Ram. Om Ram Shri Ram Jai Jai Ram. All such things. Or many, many varieties of these mantras. And if you keep doing that, you find you're getting into another state of consciousness. You're not thinking in the ordinary way. As the words, let's take any English word, take the word yes. We know, we think we know, yeah, yes means, it means yes, you know, I will. But say it several times, yes, 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 yes. And strike you, we use that funny noise. Yes, 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 yes. And after a while it stops meaning anything. This becomes a noise. And that's the way, you, through using thought symbols, you free the mind from thought. It's like using a thorn to pick out a thorn that's stuck in the skin. And so yoga uses those, and breathing, to help the mind to become quite still. Now those, you see, are vikalpa in that they are gimmicks. So through breathing and mantras and so on, you get vikalpa samadhi, samadhi, samadhi with gimmicks. And that means that you have a crutch for your religion. It depends on some kind of an extraneous device. But the ideal of yoga is called the natural state, which in Sanskrit is sahaja. To be in the state of realization without having any religious gimmickry. What Spiegelberg of Stanford used to call the religion of no religion. Again, it's look mama no hands. So that you don't need to do anything special, or to think any special thought, or to say any special prayer, or to have any particular ritual on which you depend for getting into the realized state of consciousness. But you're in it naturally all the time. That's nirvikalpa samadhi. And this means then that you could seem to the outsider as living a perfectly normal life, that you eat when you're hungry and sleep when you're tired, and you go about your business. And nobody can tell you from just anyone else, unless they know you very well. And that's considered in all Hindu and Buddhist thinking very, very fine achievement. It's compared with a bird flying through the sky and leaving no tracks. Or with geese flying over a lake. And although they are reflected in the lake, they don't disturb the water. They leave no trace. So one might say that the ideal of yoga is to go through religion and get rid of religion. Because religion is a medicine. And it should not be a diet. That, you see, is a fundamental difference between physicians and clergymen. A physician tries to get rid of his patients. He gives them medicine in the hope that they will go away and not come back. But unfortunately, the clergyman tries to get you hooked on the medicine so that you'll come to church every Sunday and pay your contribution to pay off the mortgage. That's a very serious problem with churches. The investment in buildings and such liabilities. But the doctor, you see, although they have these hospitals, they hope that the turnover will be big enough to pay for it. And they can't get a big turnover unless they're successful in getting rid of patients. But the patients who have been successfully got rid of go and recommend this doctor to other patients. And so they keep coming through because they're always sick people. And the Hindu, in a way, and especially the Buddhist, take very much this view of religion. Religion is not something to get hooked up on. A person hung up on religion or hung up on yoga is felt to be still in bondage. So yoga is to get rid of yoga and come to the final state here called Nirvikalpa Samadhi, where you are in the realized state naturally. Now, of course, the doctrine of the Upanishads is that everybody is in the state of union, of yoga, of union with Brahman, whether you know it or whether you don't. And so, trying to have that state naturally is really and truly doing something redundant. You are trying to be where you are, to become what you are. But that's because you don't know you're there. And we can see, if we go back, why you don't know that you're there. Because if you are the Brahman, you in the beginning of things deliberately pretended you weren't. Only you did it so well that by now you've forgotten you did it. And so to wake up again, you have to press on trying to get back, although that's unnecessary. You will only learn that it's unnecessary through trying to get there. Sort of making a fool of yourself, trying to get what you already have. So that in a way, I've been told that there are idiots who sit in padded cells trying to catch their thumb. You know, you put your hand round your thumb like this, so here's your thumb wiggling like that, and then you say, ooh, whoops, let's try and catch it. No, no, it went away. Whoops, no, no, it's gone, oh, see? You can't catch it. Because, of course, it's the thing you're trying to catch is the catcher. So in the same way, when you set out to realize that you are the ground of being, the Brahman, you're doing just that. You're trying to catch your own thumb, see? And it doesn't work. And you think, oh dear, this is becoming a very difficult task. I must ask my teacher about it. I must be sure he's a good teacher, because I've set myself this very, very tough problem. But it's a silly problem. Only in most cases, it takes years of sweating at it to see how silly it is. But that's all it amounts to, basically. So what happens in yoga is that you get a set of hurdles, discipline hurdles, to go through. And I'm only giving you a very, very sketchy account of this, because I could go into all kinds of technicalities. But you can read those in the books. All about the chakras up the spine, and the complicated ways of breathing to awaken the different chakras or levels of consciousness and all that jazz. But all that is jazz, essentially, over certain fundamental principles. And what I want to be sure of is that you get the fundamental principles. That, in other words, you have lost your sense of harmonious coherence with the whole domain of being. And you're puzzled as to what's the right thing to do, what's the wrong thing to do, how I ought to be, how to control my mind, how to do this, that, and the other. And everybody has contradictory advice for you. He who hesitates is lost. Look before you leap. Many hands make work light. Too many cooks spoil the broth. Religion, everything, wisdom, is full of contradictory advice. So they say to you in the end, ah, but you see, it takes a wise man to know when to do which. Well, they say, you say, how do you become wise? Well, it's a matter of experience. It's like you apply for a job and they say, well, how much experience do you have? Well, you say, I haven't had a job before. Well, you must get one, and then we can give you one. To him that hath shall be given. And it's the same way all these people talk. You ask a question, and the guru answers. When you know the answer, you won't ask the question. Well, that's pretty obvious. All this frustration. But you see, the real meaning is, the question you're asking is a false problem. You're asking, in other words, why do people inquire into religions? Why do they go to teachers? Why do they want spiritual exercises and practices? Because they feel unhappy. Because they feel well, not really because they feel, because they think. When you feel unhappy, that's one thing. But when you think you feel unhappy, that's much more of a problem. Because you keep repeating over and over and over to yourself, gee, I feel depressed. Oh, I feel just so put down. And you wrap your tongue around that, like, you know, when you've got a filling out of a tooth, your tooth keeps wandering into the hollow, your tongue keeps wandering into the hollow left by the filling, and you fuss with it. The same piece of time if you get an itch or something, you keep scratching it. Some people, if they get a pain in a certain part of the body, keep moving it so the pain is there. And they wonder if it's still there, and they can't help doing that, you see? So in this way, we talk ourselves into problems. And so all this kind of thing starts up. But actually, the problem is an attempt to solve an impossible conundrum. That's the most frustrating problem of all. See, all sensible questions have sensible answers. How do you cook swordfish steak? Problem. Well, someone can tell you. It's quite simple. How do I draw a square circle? Well, the question doesn't mean anything. So naturally, there's no answer to it. So, how can I get myself into a state where I'm always happy? How can we arrange things in this room so that they're all up? Silly question. So was the other one. How can I attain peace of mind? Well, there's a Zen story about that, where the master says, bring out your mind and I'll pacify it. And the questioner says, but when I look for my mind, I can't find it. He said, there, it's pacified. So that's the sort of thing that's going on in yoga. You know, you think you're a problem to yourself. And so that guru says, find you. There was this great sage in India, Sri Ramana Maharshi. And people used to come, but he lived in modern times. It's not the same as the Maharishi that you know about from recent times. But Ramana, he was a wonderful man with the most beautiful, big, humorous eyes. And always sat half naked with a little loincloth around him. And he'd sit in a kind of patio or a compound and read the newspaper. And sometimes he'd meditate, and sometimes he'd sleep, and sometimes he'd answer questions. And throngs of people came from all over the world and sat in this compound just to watch him. And there were chickens around scratching and mothers feeding their babies and dogs and so on. And he took very little notice of it all, but they just wanted to sit in his presence. And they would come to him and say, "Oh, Maharshi, who was I in my past life?" And he'd come back and say, "Who wants to know?" "Oh, Maharshi, how many years will it take me to attain liberation?" He'll say, "Who wants to attain liberation?" Always, he'd throw every question back on the source of the question. "Who are you?" Well, that's something you see you can't get hold of. That's this thing, you see. "Who am I? Wow. Who am I?" Can't get it. So the yoga teacher sets you to doing this as fast as he can get you going, as ruthlessly, as relentlessly. "Who are you? Find out when you breathe. What is breathing? Find out when you know. What is knowing? Get to the root of the matter. Ask, ask, ask. Inquire, inquire, inquire." And one day, it all becomes clear. And it's so simple, that is the most difficult thing in the world to explain. It's like, you just see, this is it. This is the way it is. There is no problem about it. Death, suffering, these aren't problems. They're awful if they are problems. The worst kind of suffering is that which you think there might be a way out of. When you know there isn't, it's easier to bear. So, this sense of it all being perfectly clear and simple and transparent, this experience now that you are having at this moment, is what it's about. This is the beatific vision. This is cosmic consciousness. This is where it's at, baby, you know? And it just becomes clear like that. But you see, when you say that to someone who may not have had such an experience, they say, "So what? You mean it's just what's going on now?" I would say, "Why do you use the word just for what's going on now?" Because that means you're only half awake, if awake at all. You are bolting your life like some people bolt their food. And you think you've experienced now. Or you say, "I have now, after now, after now, after now, after now. I go, boop, that one goes down, boop, that one goes down, boop, that one goes down, boop, that one goes down. I still feel hungry. I want the good one. I hope that somewhere down on the end of the line in the future is going to be a sudden now experience which will be, that's the thing I wanted." But tomorrow never comes.